Welcome, podcast listeners, to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast in the Blabbernacle, where we keep Mormonism weird. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kithel.
How'd you like that intro?
Oh, it was beautiful. I loved it.
I think I finally got
it. I'm feeling pumped up. You didn't say Blabbernacle. I'm ready to go. Let's do this.
Before we get started talking about today's episode, I have to pay some respects. Midweek, we released the discussion about reacting or responding or thinking through John's discipline, John's excommunication. And we had Mormon Matters, we had Dan Weatherspoon, Joanna Brooks, we had me from Rational Faiths, and we had Natasha from Mormon Mental Health, and I'm going to claim Jennifer Finlayson-Fyth from Rational Faiths. And these are kind of like the middleway podcast people. And I totally neglected the good folks at a Thoughtful Faith podcast. Gina Colvin, James Patterson, Mark Krigo, those guys. They've done some great stuff. If you're not, you're probably already listening to both podcasts periodically. But if you haven't, you should go and check them out. And actually, there's an interview with Steve Peck, who is our guest today. There's an interview, it was probably 4 or 5, maybe 6 months ago, I'm not sure. It was a while ago, though, where they had a good discussion about evolution, his authorship, and the books, the different works that he's written, although our discussion on his authorship was even better. but they also talked about environmentalism as Mormons, and so that one's a really good one. Gina's putting out a lot of great stuff by interviewing people more from the international parts of the church, people from New Zealand where she's from, people from England, and lots of different personalities. And so I just want to shout out to my good friends at A Thoughtful Faith Podcast.
Yeah, and that's tough because whenever you're doing these kind of collaborative things, that you're never going to be able to include everyone because there's more, I think, important voice. The world of Mormon podcasts and blogs and all that stuff is so huge. But yeah, that's a good point. I also definitely appreciate what they are doing as well. So that's awesome.
Yeah. So today on the podcast, we have an interview with Steve Peck, and this is actually a continuation of an interview I did with my friend Benjamin Knoll, who's a political science professor down in Kentucky. He and I both talked with Steve Peck, and the first part of the interview was released many months ago about the different works that he's authored. And this part, which is a little bit over an hour, is all about evolution and his understanding of evolution. He gives sort of a primer, very, very short synopsis of what evolution is, and how that became a problem in the early 20th century in Mormonism as some of the leaders embraced the rise of Christian fundamentalism.
Awesome. Yeah, and we've talked about this before throughout our science series, but Stephen Peck is a little bit more philosophically savvy, and he I see him as just a really good thinker and scientist.
Yeah, and the first 20 minutes or so are all talking about some of the philosophies that, like positivism, for instance. If you've never heard of that, you'll learn what it is. We talk about a few philosophies that are related to science or one that's related to religion. And so he's really good because he's actually a professor. He teaches courses on the philosophy of biology. So it's a really good discussion. I wanted to go on and on and on. I had to cut it short. So we might have to, if listeners are interested and I'm interested and I can get his, if I can actually get his schedule to calm down enough so I can talk with him, I'd love to have Steve back on again and ask him more questions and see what his thoughts are. Yeah. But he offered some interesting and creative thoughts about evolution and how it might mesh with our theology. And but he also takes the stance that it, you know, it might not, it might be a problem, but he doesn't necessarily see that it is, because we're going to continue to learn more and more. And so I think you'll really enjoy this discussion. I'm back with Steve Peck and Ben Knoll again. Why don't you guys say hi, Steve?
Hi. Glad to be here. Thanks for doing this.
And Ben?
Hey, it's good to be back again.
Okay, so this time around we're continuing our science series, and Steve, as our evolutionary biologist, is going to help clarify some things, maybe some questions you've had growing up or are still wrestling with evolution and Mormon theology or Mormon beliefs. And so I think we should just jump right in.
Okay.
Science gets thrown around a lot, I think, especially by people that have taken a couple science classes or something, and you know, maybe they really like Nova shows, and they'll say, well, science says, especially if it's in line with their political affiliation or their political leaning, science says this. Uh-huh. So I think we should talk about first, what really is science? What does science actually say? And where are those jumping off points where we make a conclusion based off of physical evidence that we have? And so I've got a list of philosophies that are at least associated with science. Maybe they're not necessarily philosophies of science, but let's go through some of those things so that we can illustrate where people take this leap.
Okay. I don't know if you know, but I teach the history and philosophy of biology at BYU. And so I think a lot about philosophy. I've actually have a number of philosophy of science papers. So this is one of my favorite areas. So if I start blabbering too long, or let me know. I love this stuff.
All right. So positivism.
Okay. So positivism it was an especially popular philosophy of science at about the turn of the century, 19th century, 19th to 20th century. And it was a view that the way you did science was you made verifiable claims. And if you could make verifiable claims and then use science to verify them, show them that you could, that's how science should be done. And so it became very strident in terms of what kind of statements were verifiable and what kind of statements weren't verifiable. And it spent a lot of time sort of dismissing metaphysics, metaphysics being sort of what underlies your scientific task. So it didn't ask, like typically now with philosophy of science, we ask questions about, you know, realism and constructivism, the two views that, you know, when we talk about electrons, we're talking about real entities, or is that just a handle to help us interpret data? But back then they thought in terms of these verifiable statements, and it was undermined by a philosopher named Popper, who pointed out that really no matter what you verify, you really can't ever know that that's true, because you might find a case where you know, one more experiment dismissed what you'd verified, or you'd misunderstood it, and brought in the idea that you should make falsifiable hypotheses rather than focus on verification. And so it's been through the kind of these iterations of you know, how do you get at the truth? How do you form theories? How do you form hypotheses that are testable, and when compared with the world that you gather data about, and how do you move science forward that way? And so
okay.
I think we've reached a point in science where we recognize that it's a lot messier than it was. I mean, I kind of grew up with my idea of science coming completely out of Gilligan's Island. I mean, the professor, he knew everything. You know, he was, you know, he could mix chemicals and, you know, identify, you know, tribal languages, fix radios, you know, identify plants and animals and seashells.
That's what a scientist does.
I know, and I think how disappointed everybody if I was on the island and they say, well, you know, what kind of plant is this? I say, oh, you know, I really did insects. I don't know. And they say, what kind of insect is this? I say, well, you know, I really was focused on test flies, so yeah, I don't really know. You know, I'd just be a disaster. They'd have me try to get me to fix a radio, and I wouldn't have a clue. That science gave certainty. It just handed you certainty. If science said something, you were handed certainties that you could, you know, bank on. And I think scientists are a lot humbler now and realize that this is a messy enterprise, but it is, I don't want to undermine it because it is powerful. Nothing in human history has touched the advances that science has made. And, you know, when somebody says they don't really believe that, I say, well, next time you go to the doctor, tell them you want the 1950s treatment. Tell them to do the procedures from the 50s. Since science doesn't make progress, then, you know, you'll be fine with that.
Bloodletting works, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Get the leeches out, yeah.
Yeah, get the leeches. Or get your giant, we shall use my largest scales. So let's, just to clarify, positivism is using verifiable claims.
Right.
Distinguish that from the falsifiable hypothesis.
Okay, so the classic example is if, for example, you want to claim all swans are white. And in a way, it doesn't matter how many white swans you bring me, because that's not what would refute the claim. Now, if we travel the world visiting lakes and we see nothing but white swans wherever we go, we start to sort of get an inductive sense that maybe that's correct. But to refute that is really easy. We just have to find one black swan. And so a falsifiable hypothesis would state that, you know, there are at least one non-white swan, and you bring it, and you've made progress. You've learned something about swans. Whereas just by seeing instances of the same thing over again, you don't really gain as much information. You do gain information. I mean, it's not that verificationism is just completely wrong. It's just that it's not as strong, and it's easy to refute.
So the claim of having all swans white, as soon as you find a bunch of swans that are white, you've verified it.
Right.
And then falsifying it is working the other direction.
Right, right.
Exactly. Okay.
That's what
okay,
I,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I teach the social science research methods class here at where I work, and just a couple of weeks ago we went over this, like, hypothesis testing and that kind of a thing, and the way that we talked about it was that you never, ever, 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 ever can prove anything true, but rather you just fail to disprove it over and over and over again, and that's how it works these days. So I said that's what scientists do, is they just try to prove themselves wrong as strong as they can, and if they can't, then we say that something's supported or there's evidence in favor of. But I said never say prove, like just strike that from your vocabulary in science.
Once though you start, you know, the nice thing about science is you're sort of working to build theories and trying to, you know, your theory makes certain predictions. And to the extent that those predictions come true, you start to get a sense that, okay, there's no other theory that really predicts this, or I don't have one. And not until you find one can you change it. So it is messy in that sense. It's not exactly like you have a recipe for doing it, but it's sort of theory driven. It's so complicated, it's really hard to put it into small words. Because I spent a whole semester thinking about this, but trying to think of how I could talk about the messiness. Just one of the things that they've realized is how seeped in things like playfulness and in laboratory sciences traditions of how to do things that don't get put in scientific papers. But I think the one strong thing about science, the absolutely most powerful thing about it is the way that it proceeds from models to peer-reviewed papers. It's always open. And so it's an arena where you have to put your ideas forward for other people to inspect and people who are trained in your area. And so they're very quick to find flaws, to find problems. And I think this is being recognized as probably the greatest strength of science is its openness. It's, you know, you have to meet this really rigorous requirement to get it published. Other people have to evaluate your methods, your analyses. And it is, I mean, peer review is horrible for a scientist.
It's not because, for the weak of heart, right?
Yeah, it's not for the weak of heart.
The faint of heart. Yeah.
Scientists are in competition for limited funds, for limited journal space. And it really is kind of a Darwinian competition. And so people, you know, I hear some people saying, you know, scientists are in a big conspiracy and they're all biased and trying to support each other in the same story. And if you're in science, you know it's the exact opposite. You're trying to undermine anybody you can to get ahead. And so, you know, it's a bloody battle. I compared it to a bunch of pit bulls being placed into arena and only the strongest survive. You know, the best ideas are those that emerge conquerors in the competition.
Yeah, that was right in my first papers or so. That was rough.
Yeah.
I've done all this work. It's good.
Yeah.
No.
Nope. Nope.
Yeah. Okay, so let's jump on to ontological materialism.
Okay, so this is an interesting thing because it often gets confused in science by scientists. So a lot of the new atheists who, you know, are arguing science is all we need are ontological materialism. And really it's an assumption. It's not a scientific fact. In fact, it can't be a scientific fact. And that's that everything in the universe is just materially driven. It's just stuff, matter in motion. That's all everything is. And it's actually seen as problematic by a lot of scientists who are working in emergent systems and things where sort of new processes come into the universe that are hard to just define as matter in motion. But it's an assumption that everything that happens is essentially a matter in motion. Now, that said, it's absolutely an assumption of science that everything is methodological materialism. And that's that you assume that everything is material and you work from there. I mean, and that's why science can't touch everything. For example, literature, the arts, all these kinds of things, ethics, values, they don't lend themselves to the same kind of scientific analyses. Not everything can be quantified. Not everything's non-subjective. And so, the things that science can touch though are those things that we think are material. And, you know, a lot of times scientists get confused and think, well, that's all there is in the world. That's all I see. That's all I work with. And it is an assumption of science, but people shouldn't be bothered by that. I have this analogy that I make because we all know, well, methodological materialists. And an example is our car mechanic. And when we take our car that's making a funny noise to the mechanic, we absolutely assume methodological materialism. We're assuming that there's something mechanical wrong with the car. There's something at fault that the mechanic can, you know, twist bolts and, you know, put in the right things and make it work again, then it's completely all material. So the scientific assumption of methodological materialism, I think, shouldn't cause people to worry, you know, that scientists are all materialists. But it's the right assumption for science. I agree with the assumption. I make that assumption when I do science. So that's sort of the difference between ontological materialism. You assume there's only material, mechanical things in the universe. The universe is a big clockwork. And that'll get you a long ways, actually. Methodological materialism is going to be able to study lots and lots and lots of things.
It's not going to be able to tell you why a rose is beautiful, necessarily.
Exactly. And you know, okay, you can study it psychologically, you can do science on that, but the feeling of beauty, that sense of wonder, you know, there are other things in the world that go beyond the mechanical and the material.
So what about a certain group of scientists, theoretical physicists and mathematicians? Are they methodological materialists, or are they ontological materialists, or are they philosophers?
Sometimes all three at once. It depends on if you put them through a slit.
And then there's only a certain amount that end up.
You'll see a wave pattern, and sometimes you'll just see a particle formation. No. No, I think you know, that's a thing. I've been trying to follow sort of the new physics, and it's really interesting to see. You know, you've got people arguing that essentially physics is math. They have a sort of a Platonic view of it, like Plato's Forms, that math is real. You know, I don't know where that actually fits in the scheme of things. Most physicists, though, they tend to, you know, all of their experiments, because, you know, they work with particles and things, they're dealing with the materials of the universe. And so they're certainly methodological materialists, but, you know, a lot of times that leans you towards being an ontological materialist
too. Yeah.
Unless you start looking at the atoms way, way down there, and then you start to envision strings which aren't available to us.
Yeah.
So it gets sloppy when you get, you know, a good mechanical physicist, you know, shooting cannonballs and propping up things with levers probably never runs into this.
No. A couple hundred years ago, that's what they did.
Yeah, exactly.
I always wondered, it drove me nuts in math classes, whether they discovered an equation or they developed an equation, you know, whether it was a discovery or an engineering feat.
Right.
And, you know, and I guess that's a philosophical, however you view that.
It blows my mind. I mean, I write on the board, you know, that E, you know, the Euler's constant, Euler's constant, to the pi I is -1. That blows my mind. You can raise a transcendental number to another transcendental number multiplied by an imaginary number and get -1. That's just, you know, that's mind-blowing.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in math that's just... People, you know, a lot of people think that math is arithmetic and algebra, and they don't understand when it gets beyond... When you start using letters, I don't know what you're doing anymore.
Right.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Right.
Then you're, you know, adding up in infinite series.
Yeah, adding infinite series, dealing with rings, fields, all kinds of stuff that just I didn't even go there. It's just too much. So how does science? So science does not talk about dualism at all. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that would be more of a religious sort of thing.
Right.
Let's explain dualism, since we are talking about religion a little bit.
So dualism is the idea, it's very familiar to every Latter-day Saint, is the idea that there's essentially something else available in in us, essentially that we have a spirit, that there's a dual nature that we don't know anything about, we can't get at from the material world, and so typical belief, and this is not just Mormons, that a lot of religions believe in a soul, that is not something material. It has a completely different makeup, and is unavailable to the material world as such. And so that's kind of dualism in a nutshell, is the typical Mormon belief of a body and a spirit.
Yeah, and Joseph even frustrates that because he has the spirit is matter, it's just more fine, you can't see it with your impure eyes or right. Something like that.
That's interesting. I mentioned this in one of my papers on consciousness, is that in a way Mormons are the ultimate materialist because even our spirits are material.
Yeah.
And so... You know, do we count as dualists, or I kind of think we do because the material is not available to us
right.
in the material world. But you know, if you want to kind of shrug off the sort of baggage that comes with just a completely immaterial soul, we can do that because we have a material spirit of inner nature.
Yeah, you can't nail Mormonism down if you try. There'll always be some statement or something that we hold on to, and it's going a different direction. Okay, so we've done the philosophy stuff, and so really science, it's done a lot, but it still sort of takes a, I don't know if I want to say humble, but a, I don't know, it's self-skeptical, I would say, is the takeaway message.
Yeah, and the takeaway message, I think, is the science will always follow the data, wherever it leads. So if your most cherished theory is this whole start to appear in it, there's data that doesn't seem to support it, then science will abandon that. I mean, the classic case of that was continental drift. For a long time, you know, nobody had a mechanism that you could move continents, even though there seemed to be, the continents did seem to kind of fit together and the strata kind of fit together, but there was no mechanism. And so, you know, if you talked to somebody in the 1930s, they would have laughed at you for continental drift, but as mechanisms like seafloor spreading and subduction zones appeared, and mechanisms began to be in place, and then they started, you know, that opened questions, well, can we measure that? And they drill holes and see that the older rock was, you know, further away from the spreading zone, and all of a sudden, science rewrites itself. And that's, I think, that one of the power of science is they're willing to follow the data. And so it requires a humility, and sometimes individual scientists have trouble doing that. I mean, there were some holdouts against continental drift well into the 70s. And, you know, now no one would say that it's not true. But, you know, it's being a scientist is, you don't want to let go of your theories too easily. You know, you don't want every wind that blows some data your way to throw away things that are very solid. And so that's the kind of humility I'm talking about, is this idea that you can't hold on to something in light of further data without examining it, re-examining it, and making sure, you know, that whatever you're embracing involves the latest and greatest data. And if it requires leaving what you've assumed is true your whole life, you do it.
Let's jump into the evolution basics. So give us where evolution really got started, what were the key point, or what are the key factors that push evolution forward, and especially I'd like to get some modern examples. I know I'm putting like three questions in here, but some modern examples of evolution, because a lot of times you hear, well, yeah, it happened, but not anymore.
Yeah.
But as I understand it, there's very good examples of evolution within the last 100 years or couple hundred years.
Yeah, yeah, there is. So the evolutionary story actually, evolution's a lot older than Darwin, but nobody had a mechanism for change. You know, people saw fossils and things and assumed change, and there were different theories that popped up. But when what Darwin did, and this was, I think, probably puts him for me and for many the greatest scientist that ever lived, because he put together a mechanism for evolution to proceed, and that's natural selection. And so basically what evolution requires, it requires three things. It requires variation, and then it requires some mechanism of heredity, and then it requires some selective force. And so the basic idea is really simple to understand. You know, if you have a population of some animal, and there's variation in that population, there's also there's a scramble for resources. Every organism on Earth is scrambling for some kind of resources, and if you're better at that than your neighbor, then your offspring are going to do better. They're going to be the ones that survive. And those that survive go on to breed. And so that's the basic requirement for evolution. It's very, very simple. In fact, you can get this to work with, you know, computer simulations, whatever. You put those three things together and you see changes in frequency. And so evolution is just this idea change happens over time. We have a really clear picture of how genes are organized on DNA strands and how you know, those change, how mutations occur, how mutations are selected for. And it's appearing to be a much more complicated story than we ever realized. Now people are joining evolution with sort of developmental embryology, which plays a huge role in how novel things emerge in the universe, and ecology and all these things work together. But the basic story remains the same. There are complications, and those complications are, you know, fun and interesting to evolutionary biologies. But this in our evolution classes at BYU, we still teach the basic Darwinian story and then add nuances onto that, but it's still the basic story.
The initial evidence was Darwin looking at different traits that he saw,
right,
like the story of the finches and the Galapagos Islands.
Yeah.
But what are some other key examples that have come? Now, I actually started as a geology major, so I looked at a lot of the fossils and stuff, and that was my exposure to evolution, was the fossil record. But what if we ignore that? What, from the Galapagos onward, what were the big observations in verifying evolution that way?
Well, there's several lines of evidence. There's evidence, like you said, the fossil record's huge evidence. Darwin predicted exactly right that you'd find the older forms in the deeper layers, and then the evolution of in the fossil records, absolutely stunning. But also other some of the evidences that we've gathered now through DNA, looking at how closely related different organisms are, where they branch off, how they come together, the way that biogeographically you find similar species in similar habitats, like the Galapagos finches, are really very closely related to Ecuadorian Finches. Their sort of parental form is well known on the mainland, and we can see the evolution of radiation. If you look at island populations, you can trace almost, you know, always back to what the ancestral population was, and it's typically the closest mainland. And so we see evidence everywhere we look, from the forms that things have, from DNA. And this is one of the things that makes evolution so strong, is that every aspect we look at, we see it. You can get it to happen in laboratory populations of bacteria. You can get it to happen to populations in, I do a lot with insecticide resistance, watching the insects evolve away from being resistant to pesticides and things, are examples. Yeah, you'll often hear the complaint, well, you don't see them change species. And that's not even true, because we do see changes in species. There's some work at BYU on lizards. We're watching them change in their natural habitat right away. I mean, the people who are studying this, I'm not studying this, but the people who are. And so there's a biologist from the 30s named Dobzhansky, who said that nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of evolution. And that's absolutely true. It explains everything that we study in biology, from the way our bodies work to the species that we see all over the world. So it's a well established story. I mean, once you get to know it, and there's some great books you can read, like Our Inner Fish and
Neil Shubin.
Yeah, yeah.
The Tiktaalik Fish. Yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah, it's a great book. And so, you know, the story's there. People who argue against it, I often am surprised they don't take the time to read these books to see what they're arguing against, because it's a stunningly wonderful and compelling story. So I'm obviously a big fan of it.
I would always say, coming from a geology background, that there is literally mountains of evidence for evolution.
There is.
So this is what I do. I do public opinion and voting behavior and stuff. And in 2007, the Pew Research Center did a huge religious landscape survey of like 35,000 Americans. And they had a subsample of about 600 Mormons in there. And one of the questions in the survey said, quote unquote, "Evolution is the best explanation for the origins of human life on Earth. Do you completely agree, mostly disagree, or completely disagree?" Among that Mormon subsample, we had completely agree at 6.5%, mostly agree at 16.6%, mostly disagree at 22.4%, and completely disagree at 54.5%.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And we could even, like, you could break it out amongst, like, higher and lower levels of religiosity there. That holds even when controlling for religiosity, if you dig into the statistics a little bit deeper on that there. So there's something in there about Mormonism and a trepidation, I guess we could say.
Yeah.
Toward this concept.
Hey, Ben, real quick, mm-hmm. Were there other religions that were similar?
So if you rank the percent who agree on this from top to bottom, we are second from the bottom in comparison with all the other American, and this is only for the United States, of course. We're right there, about tied with evangelical Protestants. We're a little bit higher than Jehovah's Witnesses, which is at 8%, but we're lower than every other group. Muslims 45%, mainline Protestants 51%, Catholics 58%, Jewish 77%. Buddhist is top at 81 there. So we're very much on the far bottom end of that spectrum.
Hmm. Yeah, that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate.
Steve, you've got some work to do.
I know.
I think, oh, boy. Okay, well, I guess we can get into the reasons why that can at least appear challenging. You know, we have Joseph Fielding Smith, we have Bruce R. McConkie, and some of these figures that are held the office of prophet, seer, and revelator, so they know the mind of God, at least to some degree. And they taught that evolution was wrong.
Yeah.
So why would they, what was so threatening, and why would they work so hard against evolution? You don't seem to hear that as much, but obviously we haven't walked away from that stance too far.
It's true, we haven't. And I think part of it is just some unfortunate historical reasons. There were general authorities friendly to it, like James Talmage and B.H. Roberts. The problem was, I think, is evolution and religion parted ways early in the first part of the 20th century. Unnecessarily, there was a rise of fundamentalism, and the claims of some religions, especially the evangelical fundamentalist religions, was that evolution dismissed God. And I think that got sort of taken up by Joseph Fielding Smith in particular. His Man, His Origin and Destiny was particularly anti-evolutionary. He wrote this not while he was a prophet, but I think it was early 50s. I don't have my notes with me, but it was around then. And most of his arguments in that book came from a Seventh-day Adventist thinker, a flood geologist, who had written a few books on flood, Noah's flood geology. He was arguing that Noah's flood was real and you could see it in the rocks. And so most of his arguments were taken from them, and there was an entrenchment early on around that time, about 1918, when BYU sent some faculty to study theology, like University of Chicago, and they came back with ideas on biblical criticism and I outline it in great detail. It would take me an hour to go through it in detail, but basically, there was a lot of tension about and concern about evolution as a source of a lack of religious faith. And, there was some unfortunate people left BYU who were teaching evolution, the Chamberlain brothers, one was a biblical criticism guy, and it sort of made people think that somehow science and academic work could lead you away from God. And I don't think that's true at all. I think the opposite's actually true. And so this entrenchment sort of flowers in Joseph Fielding Smith's book, Man, His Origin and Destiny, where he comes right out and says evolution, the same spirit that influenced Cain to kill Abel, inspired Darwin in thinking about evolution. I can't remember that quote, but it's fairly direct and devastating.
Not beating around the bush there.
No, he doesn't pull any punches. Let me tell you. It's actually kind of fun to read. His son-in-law, Bruce R. McConkie, of course, in Mormon Doctrine, which was hugely influential, dismissed evolution as being of the devil. And I think what they were keen in on, what they were looking at, is this sort of atheistic strain by some prominent scientists. And it wasn't all scientists. I think if you look at, I wish I had the statistics at hand, but prominent scientists tend to be less religious, but most scientists are just as religious as the population, which is kind of surprising. But this sort of influenced the way that church education developed. Their ideas were very, very influential. Interestingly, though, we now, from David O. McKay's biography, know that he was a believed in evolution and thought highly of it. He thought very poorly of Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine. So, you know, this sort of tension among the brethren has always existed, that Elder Nelson alluded to in conference recently. They have differences of opinion, and they have different backgrounds, and they have, you know, different histories. And so I think it's kind of an accident of history that Mormons became anti-evolutionary. They weren't in the beginning. In fact, it wasn't seen as a big deal until both science and religion began to kind of separate. They started trying to talk about the you know, the thing that for a long time people looked at nature as and its design as evidence of God. And then Darwin came along and said, well, we can explain design without God. And, you know, there's two responses to that. One response is, well, then we've been wrong about the way we've used nature as evidence. And it's always kind of a poor argument. I mean, you know, if you look at the beauty of nature, you come away thinking, oh, this is a nice evidence of a benevolent deity. But then if you look at the Tennyson's Red in Tooth and Claw parts of nature, it's pretty horrific, you know. And so it was never a very good argument, but it was well established that natural theology was kind of a big deal in terms of people talking about the evidences of God. And I think that it's unfortunate that it played out like that, because I don't think it was necessary. I don't think there's anything inherent in science or evolution that demands that we dismiss religion at all. And it could have easily have gone the other way, and unfortunately it didn't. And so in the last 10 years, I've seen students much more open to evolution. I think there's kind of a realization that this doesn't threaten faith. That it's one of the facts of the world, and we need to, you know, embrace it if it is, and find ways to make our faith compatible. And I don't think that's a problem, really.
Yeah. I mean, at least the people I talk to, evolution isn't scary.
Right.
I think they get a little nervous when you start talking about human evolution. But even that doesn't. It seems like it's a problem to wrestle with, not run away from. Exactly. Is the feeling that I get. So let's talk about some of the ways to deal with evolution with our theology. I think one thing, first of all, is like with scriptures that we have that talk about a young earth or no death before the fall. I mean, those scriptures also indicate that they may be the flaws of men, that they're not inerrant, and they're not a science book.
Right.
So that's a pretty easy footing to start off with.
Yeah.
But what about, I mean, even in our temple, we have this creation narrative with a literal Adam and Eve from which all human life came from, and it happened not a long time ago. How do you think about the Adam and Eve story, and specifically, do you feel like you have to believe in a literal Adam and Eve and this fall story, or can it be metaphorical, describing our human nature?
And I have kind of a tertium quid to another option that I think is even more palatable to me. And so, you know, we look at our sacred stories, and we receive really good direction that these things are figurative. You know, I won't go into anything that happens in the temple, but there's a real clear sense that these are not actual historical event. And it's actually kind of interesting. There's a guy named Walton. He just wrote a book on called Genesis 1, and he's an evangelical guy. And what he points out that the ancient Hebrews didn't read the Genesis story literally. And he points out, and this is kind of really interesting, especially if you're a Mormon. He points out that the Genesis story was a temple ceremony to the ancient Israelites. The temple story, it was a story showing that their relationship to God, not a story of how things actually transpired, but a story of his concern and care for his children. And the interesting thing about that is, you know, the seventh day of rest, he says that wasn't a day, you know, where the Lord kind of knocked off to throw up his feet because he was worn out. That was the symbol of him accepting the temple, that this is mine. And so I think the creation story, both originally and in our other sacred scriptures and sacred references, is actually a story of who and why the creation took place, not a creation story about how it took place. I think literal readings are just completely inappropriate. That wasn't what the original writers meant. It wasn't what the story was told for. And it's actually a fairly recent invention. Like scriptural literalism really came the way in the late 1800s with the rise of fundamentalism. Before that, reading the scriptures literally just wasn't done. In fact, Augustine rails against those who read the scriptures literally. And so it's a really recent invention. It seems old because you think you're going back to the original, you know, meaning, but you're not getting even close to the original meaning. And so for me, the question of, you know, is this history? Is it literal? Isn't even answerable. You know, the problems of trying to reconstruct history, trying to understand what happened. The scriptures don't really mean to tell us the how. I mean, I think that's the why and who. They teach us that there is someone who loves us behind that, and they have a relationship, a covenant relationship with us. But it doesn't give us any details on how that took place or what that meant. And I'm really comfortable with that. And in fact, the alternative that I referenced is, I think one of the most dangerous things we can do is become obsessed with certainty. And we're kind of drawn into that. I mean, I know as a missionary, I would often claim we have all the answers. And I was really certain about all those answers. About 90% now, which it turned out not to be right. But, you know, I was certain. I held on to certainty with a clutched hand. And I think that's probably one of the most dangerous attributes we can take, is this obsession with certainty. And I see it both in you know, LDS people, and I see it in the detractors, that if you can't have certainty, you abandon it completely. It's kind of this, you know, throw everything away if you don't have certainty about one thing. And I think that's wrong. I think we can honestly have open questions in the church. So when somebody asks me, you know, how do these fit together? I don't know. I really don't know. I have ideas. I have theories. And I know that evolution is true.
And we're certain about this. Yes.
Yeah. When I say I know evolution is true, and when I say anything scientifically, I always mean this year, you know. Give me new data. But then the gospel's true. So if I can't put those together, then I just have to leave them apart. I mean, I always think of You've heard of Fermat's Last Theorem?
Of course, it's the equation as popularized in Star Trek: The Next Generation that Picard couldn't even had solved by the time that came along, right?
Yeah, it's actually been solved.
Well, there we go.
it was solved just a few years ago. I think a guy's name was Fry, but it was absolutely clear that the theorem was true. It was basically that a to the n plus b to the n equals c to the n isn't true except for at n equals 2. And don't pay attention to that. But it was absolutely clear it was true, but nobody could prove it. Nobody knew how to put it together. Nobody knew how to take the mathematics that we had and put it together with this. And the guy that did it, I mean, essentially, in order to prove it, they had to wait until entirely new mathematics had been invented. And no one could have proved it in the 18th century. Fermat wrote it in his journal. He wrote in the side of his book where this theorem was presented. He said, I know a simple proof of this, but there's not room in the margin of this book to write it down. So people for years and years tried to find out his simple proof, but when it came down to it, it was this amazingly complex mathematics, you know, just as deep into modern mathematics as you could go. And he had to come at it from the side. And so, you know, there was never any doubt that it was true. You could, you know, zip it out into a computer into zillions and zillions of instances, but nobody could get the proof. But everybody's pretty sure it was true. But it took a long time. And I think if we're too enamored with certainty, we don't have the patience to wait out these kind of conundrums that appear before us. You know, how does evolution square with the Adam and Eve story? I don't know, and I think I don't need to worry about it yet, because I think that figuratively, the mathematics hasn't been invented yet that'll put them together. Meaning we don't really know enough about the story, and we don't know enough about the metaphysics of the fall to really dare make any claims. You know, you can have suspicions, and they're fun. And I could talk about ways that I think it could work, but I don't want to, because I think the best approach is to say we don't know yet, but we know both of those are right, so we'll run with that until I don't think everything needs an immediate answer. We can be comfortable with these kind of ambiguities and lose our being enamored with certainties and explanations where we really just don't have enough information to answer the question.
In Mormon theology, we believe in an anthropomorphic God that looks like us in terms of kind of the end product of the evolutionary line so far. And like the question that when I talk to people about, you know, Mormon doctrine and evolution is always, so if evolution is driven by random mutation and we are at this point now, did God somehow make it a non-random process for us? Like, did he guide the randomness so that we would result in the end product where we looked like him? Or is this, do you just put that in the same box as, maybe we just need to wait to find out some point in the future.
I'm too tempted to not. I have a really good answer to that. That doesn't bother me at all. I can tell you why.
Okay.
Evolutionary reasons. I can't be certain, but I have a theory. and by a theory, I mean that there really is some good explanations of that. I don't think my opinion is God doesn't need to tinker with the universe at all. I think the randomness that's written in to the very universe, the fabric of the universe that causes mutation, is enough to generate the diversity of life we see. I don't think God has to tinker at all. The intelligent design I could go on and on about, but I don't buy it. And we see no evidence for it, and there's no reason to invoke it. And I say, why not? Why not? Why couldn't God write in the very structure of the universe the way that things play out? I think getting a human form is more a condition of how many Earth-like planets there are in the universe. Now, the reason I say that is, I think, one of you mentioned Gould's Play Back the Tape. If we play back the tape, we get an entirely different set of organisms.
Right, yeah. His argument being, if you went back to rewind the clock of life, start at the very beginning, we'd have like a whole different set of everything because of the random mutations wouldn't have happened the same way the second time or the third time.
Right, and there's some things right about that. But we may end up with very similar things too. I mean, we can't rule out that possibility. Gould's hypothesis is completely untestable. But there's other possibilities, and these are as good of evolutionary biology. Well, maybe not as good as he was. He was like, you know, he was like a superstar, but he's one of my heroes. But one thing that's really clear, let me give you an example. Flight has evolved four times on Earth. It's evolved in insects, bats, pterosaurs, and birds, and they all did it in different ways. So pterosaurs are flying with their fingers. You know, they have a little super elongated finger to make that giant dinosaur wing. The bats are flying with their hand, and the birds are flying with their arm. They solved this in completely different ways. But you see that there's fairly non-superficial similarities between what it takes to fly in an atmosphere. You know, there has to be these certain attributes of a wing that you recognize it as a wing. And the same's true of the times that we see terrestrial animals return to the ocean and become fish-like. So we have fish, we have porpoises, which started out as like a hippopotamus, and they have a similar shape. If you can, you know, a lot of people anciently thought porpoises were fish, and it happened too with the dinosaurs, and an animal returned and made these things called ichthyosaurs that looked pretty much like a porpoise. And so if you have certain engineering needs, you get similar shapes back. And a really striking example of this is in saber-toothed tigers. So marsupials, the animals over in Australia that have pouches and sort of a completely different reproductive look, you know, that gave rise to kangaroos and wombats and things and opossums, all of those evolved from a very rat-like animal. Or a possum-like animal, if I don't want to be my kind of animal specific or biased. But anyway, so opossums and rats kind of look alike, right? And you put them in a similar environment and they start to diverge. And we got some really wild things in marsupials like kangaroos and then we get some things that are kind of woodchucky-like, wombats who live kind of a woodchucky life, look kind of like woodchucks. But the most striking example, too, really, there's a Tasmanian wolf who looks a lot like a dog or a coyote, and there was a saber-toothed tiger marsupial. And superficially, they look a lot alike, both elongated canines that come down. They were both hunting large Pleistocene mammals. One was hunting giant marsupials, and the saber-toothed cat in North America was hunting the giant, you know, tree sloths and things hanging around North America. But superficially, they become very, very close together. And so there's a biologist. He argues that the human form might be common in the universe if there are terrestrial environments that have a similar history where there's jungles that require grasping hands and forward vision, and that they die back and leave things on the savanna. It could be not impossible to imagine. And the universe is so big. I mean, it is just vast beyond our even imagination. If you've seen the Hubble pictures of, you know, a tiny pinprick of sky, and you see thousands of galaxies, each with, you know, 10 trillion stars. And so the possibility's there that maybe this kind of shape is inevitable, like maybe a saber-toothed tiger is inevitable. You know, the question of whether God is a mammal, I don't know. Could he have come from the dinosaurs? I don't know. Maybe. But I don't think we have to sort of, you know, I'd hate to throw out our Mormon conception of God just because it's hard to imagine the human form evolving twice, when there are reasons to think, well, it could. It's not, you know, we can't even assess the probabilities. We only have experience with this one Earth. And, right. But I'd say, you know, there's not good enough reasons to assume that it can't, to make that assumption, to dismiss faith in that idea, if that makes sense.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is not so much, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like it's not so much that this Earth was predestined or predetermined to be the home for spirit children of our Father to come receive bodies, but rather in the vast immensity of the entire universe, some planets evolved that form, and then God went and found them where they were and said, okay, that'll work.
I don't have a problem with that at all. You know, I actually don't know how it worked, but that's a perfectly reasonable explanation that's consistent with the data we have of how evolution has proceeded on this planet. There's that great Voyager where they show the evolution of a dinosaur to a hominid, you know, that's a lot like us. And, you know, it could have been that the dinosaurs could have turned into us. I don't know.
I didn't know that the Star Trek Voyager was going to come into this conversation here. But yes, that was a great episode.
I tell my students.
The distant origin theory, yes.
Yeah. I showed it to my class just the other day.
So this sounds a lot kind of like this the story that was a By Common Consent blog post back in 2012, My Turn on Earth. That's this fiction piece. It sounds kind of like that story a little bit about God looking out and seeing all the different planets and, this is happening over here.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so for me, you know, that's a story that's consistent with the data. We don't really know how it happened because we only have this Earth. We only have, you know, this one instantiation of biology to look at. But I'd say that, you know, somebody who is about to give up their faith because they couldn't put it together, I think that would be premature. I mean, there are good evolutionary reasons to think that this form could occur multiple times on multiple universes. I mean, in multiple places in this universe. So
just like evolution isn't going to make a cube-shaped fish in most oceans, it's going to make a shape that will work for those conditions. So the conditions kind of drive the form.
Right. So if there's a watery world and things are evolving on there, the fish look is a very, very likely solution to the problem of moving in that medium. There are others. I mean, you know, we've got squids that do some fantastically nice things, but, you know, we have both squids and fish. Maybe other places have other things that are, you know, unimaginable to us, but a fish shape is a good idea if you want to move through water swiftly. And it's not unimaginable that if we found another planet that we'd find a fishy-looking thing there as well. So, yeah. So for me, that's not a deal breaker. You know, it doesn't mean that God has to tweak the universe. I think it's already set up with its large size and we're seeing now that there's hardly a star that doesn't have a solar system. There's enough stuff here just to pull it off by making that part of the ground of the universe, part of, you know, the very instantiation of the laws that run it, and you know.
If you go back to your short stay in hell and finding that book that was told your life story among the infinite possibilities, it's there.
Right.
You just need enough possibilities for that book to be typed out. And so when we have the Big Bang opening up all these possibilities, all these different worlds and planets and supermassive black holes and all this stuff, eventually there's going to be something.
Right.
I mean, so the probability distribution function, you integrate that to infinity, you have infinite possibilities, and the probability is 100% it's going to happen.
Right.
So that's kind of what I see, the beauty out of the Big Bang, the beauty out of evolution, is it's providing all these possibilities and opportunities.
Right. Yeah, we could ask the question, why is the universe so big? It seems, you know, wasteful in one sense from an engineering point of view to make so many worlds. But for me, if this is written into the fabric of the universe, if you know, life itself is written in the fabric of the universe, then it's a massive size and variety makes perfect sense.
Okay, so we've talked about evolution, that it's not, it's really, you know, in your point of view, in my view, it's really quite beautiful. It explains a lot.
Oh, it is.
And it's not a threat to belief in God. It's not a threat to our theology. But, you know, we're still recovering, like Ben had mentioned, we're recovering from this sort of fundamentalist worldview. If you had the power, if you were the boss, what changes would you make in the church education system to maybe correct the course a little bit, if we might be so bold?
Oh, boy, you've given me way too much power. Yeah, so, you know, what I would do, I would honestly do this. I mean, so I've got kind of an A level and a B level. At the A level, I would actually teach them a course in evolution, because it comes up, and it's going to come up with parents and students and teachers, and I'd help them understand the basics, and help them understand that it isn't a threat, that it's actually beautiful. And a lot of times, I've had friends, and this was especially when I was an undergraduate, who genuinely believed that evolution and the church were incompatible, that they had to choose one or the other. And they'd come out of their evolution class, and it's beautiful and amazing, and the data is overwhelming. I mean, it doesn't make sense that it's not a true story. And when they felt like they had to choose between the two, it put them in a really awkward place. And and some of them left the church as a result, because they honestly believed that the two were incompatible. And that's very unfortunate, and it's very sad, because it's so unnecessary. And so I'd try to teach the seminary teachers some evolutionary biology. And the B level is I'd defang it a little bit and help them realize that it's perfectly okay, even if they can't bring themselves to buy into it, that they have to let the students know that there's nothing in the church that denies their right to their ability to become an evolutionary biologist or to engage in evolutionary biology. That the second they set up that dichotomy, that they have to choose one or the other, that they've done immense harm to the students. Because I think that's the worst thing they can do, is to leave them with the impression that they have to choose between you know, science or religion. And the second you set that up, I think you've really done some damage. And so I'd encourage them to see that even if they can't buy it, that it's okay that others do. And that's the change I'd make.
What about at the very, very, very least, assuring people that evolution is actually taught at the Lord's University
at
BYU.
It is. And what people don't realize is we have a stunningly great evolutionary program. We have people doing research. We have people doing DNA sequences, molecular biologists, and these wonderful, wonderful evolutionary biologies, all of them faithful members of the church for the most part. We have non-members on the faculty, and so I can't expect them to buy into Mormonism. But we, for the most part, our LDS faculty are absolute believers. And when I say for the most part, what I mean is, people are going to jump on that word. What I mean is that we do have non-members there. But all of the evolution faculty who are LDS are temple recommending holders, temple goers. We have very good spiritual discussions, and nobody has a problem with it. It's absolutely not an issue with our faith in evolutionary biology. And it's taught. We have evolution classes that teach the same thing that you'd find at Stanford or Harvard or anywhere else. They're better taught here, but that's...
That's right.
Of course, yes, yes, yes.
I actually think the second point that you made, that's sort of my ideal of letting people believe what works for them rather than imposing
right.
your understanding of the scriptures, but being flexible enough to allow that.
Right, right.
Because I think that's a problem in our church everywhere, where you can't give a dissenting opinion, or you can't give, like, I feel like you can't talk about the Adam and Eve story and say, well, I don't know if it was quite like this. You right. just can't say that.
Right.
It's just, it seems like it's not tolerated. So that would open up a huge world, I think, is having a little bit more tolerance for other right. beliefs that are different than yours.
The second we start using the scriptures as a bully club or a weapon, they're being misused. So,
yeah,
totally agree.
Yeah, so it's been a lot of fun.
Yes.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have to get you on another time to do more speculative stuff that some of the questions we didn't get to. Those might be fun. I don't know.
Yeah, they are.
Okay, well, thanks, and you guys have a good evening.
Yep, you too.
Great. So Stephen Peck, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. I've heard him on so many different interviews and podcasts and read a lot of his stuff, but I just am always so interested in some of the things he's talking about. Like, this particular topic of evolution for me is so fascinating, because when I was growing up, for some reason, that was like a very clear taboo for me. Like we didn't really talk about it, but like, whenever evolution was discussed, it was very clearly looked down upon in my family. And like, when I've told the story in other places, or actually on this podcast too, where when I started really thinking about these things and really trying to understand dinosaurs and understand the age of the earth and understand some of these things, and I started looking into evolution, like it was something really difficult to my mom, where she got really frustrated with a scout leader who I had been talking about, who he didn't see any kind of problems with evolution. So I think, and then I've kind of mentioned that in other places that was something that was difficult. And I've had people be like, no, that's absolutely no problem at all. But why would you think that evolution would contradict any kind of thing? You know? So it's, I think there are some kind of areas where that are a little bit complicated, and especially some of our experiences where it feels like it can't, they're opposites, you know. It's either creation or it's evolution, you know. And I love hearing thoughtful individuals kind of wrestle with some of those ideas in more thoughtful ways.
Yeah, and that anxiety towards evolution and perhaps science in general is shown in the statistics that Ben shared, that of all the religious faiths that were surveyed, we're like the second most rejecting faith there is. So people that say, oh, there's no problem with it, they're not aware of all their co-congregants or the other members around them.
Yes.
and what the way they feel or the way they think and understand evolution and how it is threatening to them, or, you know, it's threatening, so they generally disregard it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it is something that you have to wrestle with. And, you know, a lot of the statements that are problematic for us are in the scriptures. And there's been other statements since then, but the scriptures sort of provide the foundation for it. And we have to remember that the people that wrote the scriptures, they didn't know what we know now. I mean, even Nauvoo, which is like the highest point of Joseph Smith's theology, in Nauvoo, there's a book called In Old Nauvoo, written by George Givens, who is Terrell Givens' father. And it's kind of a biography of the city, but it's not like these events, it's not a biography in the sense of these events happened. It's generally what were the roads like, generally what was the commerce like, those sort of things. And there's a lot, it's not the most engaging read, but there's some interesting things. It talks about the Mormons that went up to Wisconsin to cut down trees to send timber down the river to build the city with, and interesting stuff like that. But it talks about how they understood sickness and life and death and that. And we know that when they went to Nauvoo, they were plagued with malaria. They didn't know it was malaria. They called it ague and other things like that. And they didn't think that it came from the flies or that it was transferred in any way other than the swamp air. And so they didn't have an understanding of disease and how it's transferred. They didn't know that he claims that hygiene was actually quite good. But there were other practices that were still going on in Nauvoo. I mean, the way that they think George Washington died was not by his disease. They thought he had influenza or something like that, mm-hmm. and his treatment was bloodletting.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still doing that in Nauvoo. And that one of the chapters, they talked about livestock, and they still would do bloodletting for the livestock. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that's so crazy. Like, they almost killed horses and different animals all the time. And then later on, it turns out they were still bloodletting people. And they had these charts with, like, the phase of the moon and what have you that would tell you the how bad the disease is, the size of the person, and the phase of the moon. And you put those things into this chart, and that tells you how many pints or whatever units they used back then to let out of a person.
Wow.
So, you know, they just had a different mindset, you know, and it kind of, I can understand how they would get that way, because when you're sick, you vomit or you poop or you do whatever to get the bad stuff out. And so it's like, well, if I'm feeling bad, I'm not vomiting, I don't have diarrhea, what's another way that I can get this stuff out of me? And these are old ideas that have hung around for 2,000 years or so. So, well, let's let some blood out. That'll work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were just operating in a completely different worldview than what we have now. And I think it's important to remember that.
No, I totally agree. That sounds like an argument that Karen Armstrong makes, you know, when she's talking about the Bible and talking about some of these ancient scriptures, where she kind of argues that we reading it now in a modern text want to put on our kind of scientific and modern understandings to those individuals, but that's not really like this kind of like historicity, this certain way that we look at these things. That's not the way they were seeing it, and that's not the way they kind of necessarily interpreted all of these things. So I think that's important, that we're not just saying this is the way that I understand it now, so all throughout history that's the way that people have looked at it. I think that's a good thing to remember.
Yeah. So that was fun. We're going to have a follow-up to this where we talk with a couple of theologians or scriptorians, if you will, and talk about what value these scriptures have to us now, in particular the creation narratives found in Genesis, the Book of Moses, the Book of Abraham, and we'll reference the temple endowment, but that's basically the Book of Moses as far as I can remember. But we'll talk about what value this has and what symbolic meaning these scriptural passages have in comparison to a historical meaning. Like, you know, we've through these podcasts, we've talked with these Mormon folks, and, you know, none of them are believing that the universe or world was made in 6 days. And so the question is, do those scriptures still have value to us? And so we'll talk about that. That won't be next week, but it'll be coming down the road.
Good. So what are we going to be doing next week then?
Well, next week will be the 22nd, the weekend of the 22nd. We have a new theme. We've kind of got some themes that we've carried on long term and are going to continue carry on, like the Ask the Mormon Sex Therapist with Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. And a new theme is we're going to go through top 10 Mormon history books for someone new to Mormon studies or Mormon history with Ben Park. And so that will come the first episode, which is talking about Matt Bowman's The Mormon People. That will be next week. And so every month we're going to talk with him about a book that is on this top 10 list. And so look forward to that. It was a great conversation with him that we've got recorded, and it'll be a great series, I think. To get a good footing on, if you want to know the Mormon story, here are some excellent books, and here's some framing, and this is how they came into being relative to other books or works that were that they have superseded now. So that'll be a fun one.
Yeah, no, that sounds so exciting. I'm really, really excited about that project. I mean, that's what a lot of us are. I'm always doing, looking for new things to read and study, and especially when we're trying to find the best kind of approaches and really good historical accounts. Like, I think this will be a really fun and interesting project that people will be able to follow along and get good references. So that'll be awesome. Also, I'd like to just suggest that if you're enjoying the podcast, please consider going to iTunes and giving us a review there, as it is extremely helpful, and we really appreciate it.
A 5-star review.
Yeah, yeah. I like to say honest.
Just a suggestion.
But we're so amazing. It should be 5, right?
Yeah. I agree. All right, well, keep it weird till next week, folks.